When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Welcome back to the podcast, everybody, and welcome to 2021, a brand new year. Yay, one that we hope is going to be a bit brighter than the last year. Reason to be optimistic, I think, Andrew. For one thing, we can put the phrase no deal firmly out of our consciousness now because that hasn't happened. It won't happen. A huge relief for so many UK businesses, UK industry as a whole.
Yeah, and automotive particularly,
yeah.
Just because of the amount of stuff that goes from here to there and from there to here. So, I don't think anybody yet knows whether the deal that has been done will end up being better or worse, massively, smaller, who knows, than what would happen if we stayed in. But I think everybody agrees that, you know, it's certainly going to be better than if we crashed out. So, I think that's definitely something.
Yeah, a little bit of sunshine there, just a little bit. But perhaps more importantly, COVID vaccinations are now happening. And there's talk of restrictions being lifted by sort of March time, maybe Easter. I mean, we've heard a lot of all that stuff before, haven't we? But
yes,
vaccinations has to be good news. So anyway, point being,
I'm going to have a fantastic period. It probably won't last very long, but because I'm so unbelievably old, I'm likely to get vaccinated quite a long time before you are. So I'm going to be insufferably smug. I'm going to be swanning around the place, getting out there and doing all the things that we used to take for granted. That's obviously got to be good as well.
All those freelancers like myself in their 30s and their 20s, we're all a bit stuffed, aren't we, for 3 or 4 months. This podcast is actually going to be about Formula One's family tree, and I'll explain that in more detail later on. But I think because it is the first podcast of the new year, and all of us are hoping that it's going to be a better year, we should get this episode underway by talking about the stuff that we're looking forward to in 2021. I think most specifically the new cars that we're looking forward to driving. So what's on your radar for this year?
I mean, there are all sorts of obvious things. I mean, you know, I think this is going to be the year where the electric thing really starts to bite. And I'm really looking forward to, not that I suspect for a moment that I'll do it, I'm really looking forward to driving an electric sports car. We know where the standard is at the moment. It's there with the Porsche Taycan, which I've described as being, you know, a car that is sporting in nature. But it's still not a car that I would describe as one whose primary purpose is to provide driving pleasure. It does that to an extent, but it does lots of other things too, which is what it's really all about. So I would like to think that I'm going to do that in 2021. I don't think for a moment that I will. But in the meantime, you know, we've got a new GT3 911 coming along. There's a new M3, M4 coming along. I guess, actually, of them all, the one that I'm most interested in, probably the one I know least about, is the new Lotus. Not the, how are we pronouncing it? Evija.
Evija.
Not that, because I think my views on 2,000 horsepower hypercars are probably quite well known. But the Type 131, which is, as I understand it at least, this is going to be the first all-new car that's going to be created for sort of general consumption by Lotus since it got bought by Geely. And my understanding is that they call it all new. I think that there will be some takeover from the Evora. I don't think it's, and I may be wrong about this, but my understanding is it's not 100% new, but if it is effectively, I think it's new enough to be considered as such. And it's a car, I think, that will be positioned between the Exige and the Evora. And I guess as such, it's going to be gunning for, well, I mean, probably your car, probably for, you know, A110s and for lower end Caymans and that sort of thing. And I think that's just going to, obviously I'm very interested to drive any new Lotus and any Lotus like that. But I think it's going to be so instructive, isn't it? It's going to be so informative. It's going to tell us so much about the way that the Chinese want this brand to develop. And there is all, you know, and I'm very hopeful, because, you know, if you look at what they've done with Volvo, which they also own, they've turned Volvo from an absolute sort of middle order, also ran by one of these, if you can't face, for whatever reason, buying a German car, into a brand that is absolutely desirable in its own right, you know, as good a rival to a BMW, an Audi, or Mercedes as you'd want to find. And we need them to do that again with Lotus. And they did it with Volvo just by, you know, backing Volvo, frankly. It's not like, you know, Geely has been, you know, pulling their strings like puppets saying, do this, do that. They've just said, look, you know, we bought the brand because we have faith in it. You're the guys who know much more about it than we do. Here's the money. And, you know, we will let you get on with it until we think, you know, you're not doing it right. And I think that just by giving them that autonomy and sitting back and, you know, certainly providing the means to let it all happen, but also having the common sense to recognize that the people who should make it happen are the people who are closest to the brand, you know, it's worked terribly well. And everything that I hear coming out of Lotus about, you know, their desire to keep their cars, you know, light and simple and true to the original vision, I find, you know, immensely encouraging. I think that brands, and Lotus has done it. Lotus did it in the 70s when they started going off making, you know, supercars and that sort of thing. You know, I think the brands that forget the reasons that made themselves great in the first place do so at their peril. And I think that as long as, you know, in a 21st century in a 21st century era where we know that things can never be as light as they once were, but as long as Lotuses remain the lightest cars in their class, as long as they remain technically innovative, as long as they remain absolutely focused on the provision of simple driving pleasure, then, you know, I think that there's still a great future for that company. So yeah, we will see. I'm also really interested to see what a four-cylinder C63 AMG is going to be like.
Oh,
because I can't get my head around that. I'm sure it'll be very good, and I'm sure it'll have loads of power, and it'll stack up on paper in all sorts of ways, but I don't know. I mean, you know, they're very, very clever guys. And, you know, they've done some amazing things. But really? You know, a four-cylinder? I mean, you know, my mind is open and I won't judge it for a moment until I've seen it. But, you know, if as we all believe, the next series of, you know, CE63s or whatever are going to be 2-litre four-cylinder hybrids, my jury remains completely out as to whether they can genuinely replace a large capacity, stonking V8. What about you?
Well, yes. I mean, it's not power that's the issue, is it? Because they've already got 420 horsepower or whatever it is out of their four-cylinder turbo engine.
Yeah, and once you bung a load of hybrid assistance into that, then the numbers will be fine. No doubt about that at all. Yeah.
But it's the soundtrack, it's the character, power delivery, all that stuff that you just can't replicate with four cylinders, you know, particularly one. We all love the 8-cylinder soundtrack and power delivery so much. And all of a sudden it's being taken away from us. And that's so AMG, isn't it? A V8 is so AMG. And I know they'll continue to make them elsewhere, but
to me, a V8 to AMG is what a V12 is to Ferrari. It's a kind of indivisible part of the magic, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
A Ferrari can make V8s and they can do other things, but the day Ferrari stopped building V12s, you know, something of the magic of Ferrari will go with it. And, you know, I know that they will make some V8s and that sort of thing, but, you know, I don't know. We will see. But, you know, I can see all sorts of reasons, you know, for the head for a four-cylinder hybrid to work, but very few for the heart. But, you know, maybe I'm completely wrong.
And right at the top end of the market, there are a couple of other cars that we're hoping to get a go in this year. The Aston Martin Valkyrie, the Mercedes AMG One. And, of course, between us, we've already agreed that should the invitation come in to Drive Nation, I get to drive both of them first.
I think that's very fair.
It's on the record now. That's official.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Let's see what exactly what. I think those cars are. I mean, there will be loads of people who just say that these cars are irrelevant and playthings for rich people, and they are all of that. But I just don't think you can be interested in this business without being interested in cars that do stuff that cars have never done before. I think that's just part of progress, isn't it? I think it's fascinating to experience and to see and to understand how people go about doing anything that's never been done before. And that's what these guys are doing. So, you know, I am very excited about those cars. I mean, ask me what I'd do with one if I had one. I probably wouldn't be able to provide you with a very good answer. But if I was that rich, it probably wouldn't matter either. So there's also, while we're talking about sort of top-end carbon supercars, there's the new McLaren, isn't there? Which is a critically...
The V6.
The V6, we believe, the V6 hybrid McLaren, which is, you know, and they describe this car as being the most important car that they have launched in the history of McLaren Automotive, which dates back to the launch of the 12C in 2011. It is new, as I understand it, absolutely from the tyres upwards. It has a new tub. It's made in their new facility up in Sheffield. And it's their kind of start again car, isn't it? And I think that McLaren, which has, like Aston Martin and many other brands, has had a pretty tough time of it recently. I'm very interested, for instance, to see how McLaren, which is, you know, equally wedded to the lightweighting thing as Lotus, go about doing a hybrid, which obviously have to have electric motors and battery packs and everything else, while staying true to those values. And also, you know, rightly or wrongly, McLaren is perceived to have, you know, had a few issues, particularly around build quality and that sort of thing. And this is obviously their big moment to reset all that as well. So I can't wait to see it. I can't wait to get into it. I'm really, really interested by that too.
Okay, firmly back in the real world then, there's also a little Hyundai to get excited about.
There is.
The i20N.
Yeah.
Rival to the Fiesta ST. I've had a go in a prototype,
and
it could be really good fun. It's, you know, just what you want from one of those little hot hatches, an energetic little engine, and a playful sort of chassis balance. The difference between it and the Fiesta ST is I adore the Fiesta ST. I'm on record many times as saying that, but it's got quite contrived dynamics, that very alert steering, that chassis balance is very, very throttle adjustable.
Yeah.
So, Ford have specifically engineered that car to feel a certain way. And Hyundai takes a very different approach. It just wants its N cars to feel authentic and not contrived the way that the Ford does, but more honest, more faithful. And that does play out. That does bear out in when you drive the car.
I take all that, and I actually kind of admire all that. But if the end result is less fun to drive, I mean, I don't sit there hooning a Fiesta ST around a track thinking to myself, is this contrived? You know, have they put a, you know, barn door on the back of the car, or the rear roll bar, or whatever, just to make it angle into the corner like that? And I was sitting there just sort of scratching my chin thinking, oh, I just wonder whether this feels authentic. I'm just having a good time. And surely that's what matters, isn't it? It doesn't really matter how you do it, as long as the end result gets the job done. And the job for those cars, I mean, you know, I understand with cars like, you know, Golf R's and that sort of thing, which are, you know, 10 plus grand more expensive, have a family brief, you know, and have to be able to do the long distance. I completely understand you know, the need to provide cars, that such cars with practicality, ride refinement, and all those other things. But if you're going to do a little pocket rocket, it's just got to be fun, isn't it? And that's what that Ford does so well. It's just fun. And I think you can overthink it. I think you can, you know, navel gaze and, you know, and put your hand on your brow and look into the middle distance and say, I want this to be the purest driver. But ultimately, at the end of the day, when somebody gets into it and goes hooning off around the place, you know, it's... To me, if and we said this before in this podcast, it's the only mistake that Yaris makes, the Toyota GR Yaris, is it's so caught up with being incredibly impressive and incredibly fast. It's just, it's not quite, it's like 92% as much fun as it could be. And when you drive it, you are aware of the 8% and you know that it could be there because the car's, let's face it, the car's got all the ability. They could just do that with the tuning without any problem at all. But they chose not to because they for their own reasons, they went down a different road. And, you know, I don't have much truck with that. But for me, those sorts of cars, they just have to be fun, fun, fun. I'm just not that bothered about how they get there as long as they get there one way or another.
You've expressed very precisely why I, sitting here now, why I suspect in the head-to-head the Fiesta ST is going to come ahead of the Hyundai i20N, because Ford have taken a more fun-first approach with the car. And I do just worry that Hyundai's engineers have been slightly po-faced with making the i20N, a pure sort of authentic hot hatch. And they haven't just gone, how can we make this the most hilarious thing imaginable? So, yeah, I mean, that's a fun twin test for 2021, and we'll see what the outcome is.
Should we just do a tiny bit on electrics? So we've got...
Right, go on.
Well, I mean, there are going to be some very interesting takes, aren't there? Because, for instance, we've got the Audi e-tron GT, which is their Porsche Taycan. You know, same platform, same, you know, gubbins. So it'll be interesting to see what Audi makes of that opportunity. We know what Porsche does with it. And, you know, within that realm, it is amazing. I'm going to be driving quite shortly the Mustang Mach-E, which, you know, I go into with an open mind. You know, I'm not going to be so stupid as to go in there and thinking this is going to be as much fun as, you know, something with an enormous V8 under the bonnet. I know it's trying to do a different thing, but nevertheless, you know, Ford have written the check, haven't they, by putting the Mustang name on it. So the car below has to deliver on that promise, doesn't it? So, you know, I also, you know, the Mercedes, they've got a whole slew of electric cars coming out this year, but, you know, one of which is an electric S-Class. And Jaguar, apparently, you know, are going to come up with an electric XJ. So, you know, there are going to be some really big luxury electric cars. And, you know...
Yeah, I think the first of their type, actually.
Yeah, really. And, you know, and I've always said, you know, ever since I drove that electric Rolls-Royce Phantom that they did as a sort of concept, that, you know, actually, those are the sorts of cars that electricity most favours, in theory at least, because they are silent, because they have limitless torque from low down. You know, it's a great, great source of power for an electric car, for a luxury car, except, of course, for the whole, you know, range and recharge issue. But I guess as those diminish, people will increasingly be persuaded to that way of thinking. I don't know. It's going to be an interesting year, isn't it? There's going to be all sorts of stuff from all parts of the market. I mean, every year is, but, you know, I think that 2020 has been such a weird year, frankly. I hope that when did we go into lockdown? It was March, wasn't it, originally?
Yeah.
That by the time we've hit that anniversary, that things will be really getting back into their stride, and, you know, normal service will be, you know, if not completely back to where it was, but, you know, well on the way.
And it's in March that the 2021 Formula One season is scheduled to get underway. And there's plenty to look forward to there as well. We've got some driver changes that will be quite fun. We've got Ricciardo to McLaren, we've got Sainz to Ferrari, Perez to Red Bull. Also, and this brings us on to the topic for this week's episode of the podcast, we've got Alpine and Aston Martin joining F1.
Yes. Can I just say how sorry I feel for Alex Albon?
Oh, okay. Right, fine. Yeah, go on.
I just do. I mean, you know, I know that, I mean, you know, there cannot be Well, I mean, unless your name's Bottas, I guess. But I was about to say there cannot be a sterner test in Formula One than being Max Verstappen's teammate. And if he could have cracked qualifying and have got, you know, within a tenth of Max instead of five tenths. And so if he'd always started that much further up the grid, I'd be really, really interested to see how he would have got on. Because, you know, if you look at particularly his ability to overtake things and that sort of thing, he is a proper racing driver, isn't he?
Yeah.
And I just, you know, I just feel there is a story yet to be told there. And my fear is that he's not going to get to tell it. I really hope I'm wrong. Sorry.
No, it's okay. Actually, it's a good topic because the trouble is he was just driving Max's car, wasn't he?
Exactly. And you, it's a very good point, Dan, because, you know, you look at, talk to anybody who was Michael Schumacher's teammate, and they were doubly stuffed because, A, they were stuffed because, frankly, none of them was as good as Michael. But secondly, they had to drive Michael's car, and Michael liked his car set up in a very particular way, which, you know, and so they were designed to be incredibly pointy. You know, he was very much of the, you know, he was an oversteer merchant. He just liked, you know, as long as the front got where he wanted to be, he'd sort out the back himself. And, you know, that made the cars incredibly agile. And with somebody with that level of talent and reactions, incredibly quick. But if you were 1% off that, what you actually had was a car that was incredibly difficult to drive. And, you know, maybe that's what Alex has been dealing with all year. So I wish him all the best.
Mm. Yeah. Well, we'll see if Perez is able to get any closer what seems to be a tricky car. So, yeah, there is, in F1, a lot to look forward to, including, as I said, Alpine and Aston Martin joining the fray. Although, let's not pretend that they've invested in wind tunnels, hired racing car designers, set up new facilities. Actually, it's just existing teams changing colours.
Let's be honest, they're not Aston Martins or Alpines, are they? But, you know, is a Red Bull a Red Bull?
Yeah.
Yeah, is Red Bull a fizzy drink manufacturer which pays a huge amount of money to a Formula One team to make cars for them? I mean, you know, the lines are very blurred, aren't they?
Mm. Yeah, and it's title sponsorship, and it's how one team becomes a different team. It's certainly in terms of, you know, the colours and what it's called, but actually the team remains more or less the same. And this is where we start looking into Formula One's family tree, teams being taken over, relocated, expanded over time. And it explains how the tiny team founded by Ken Tyrrell way back in perhaps he was going in the 50s, I think, but 60s in Formula One, how it eventually became the Mercedes Formula One team that we know today with a record-breaking 7 back-to-back championship doubles. It's just so interesting that you can directly trace Mercedes lineage back to Ken Tyrrell's team.
You can, and people will say it's a bit sort of Trigger's Broom, isn't it? That none of the people there now would have been there. But, you know, to me, it doesn't really matter, you know, because there is that continual heritage. You know, it wasn't that. It's not like they've just, you know, do you remember when, for instance, Romano Artioli started Bugatti again in the mid-1990s? He just picked a name off the shelf and bought it and then created a new car company. It's not that. This is one team that evolves with different names, you know, for, you know, well over 50 years now. And it's, you know, it's always been the same team. And as you say, it's expanded and staff have changed and locations have changed and everything else. But, you know, from then until now, it has just continuously evolved. And it is absolutely fascinating, I think.
Mm. Yeah. Before we move any further, do we need to explain for our overseas audience the Trigger's Broom reference?
Oh, yes, almost certainly, yes. So Trigger was a character in a well-known British sitcom called Only Fools and Horses. He was a dustman or someone. Anyway, he had a broom, and he said he'd had the same broom for the last 25 years, and he said it's had 18 new heads and 17 new handles, and hence the concept of Trigger's Broom, because obviously, clearly, it was no way related to the original broom whatsoever. So, yes, that's
it's
what Trigger's Broom is.
A very common phrase in the UK, isn't it? Trigger's Broom.
Yes.
Okay. Right. Well, there are four Formula One teams, all UK-based, that I think we're going to talk about in a bit more detail.
Before we do, and I'm sorry to butt in, if we'd actually structured these things, then, there wouldn't be need for me to do this. But because we just kind of wing it, the idea of sort of title sponsorship, which, you know, I'm sure people will get, you know, hot under the collar, as they did with Lotus in whenever it came back in the early 2010s, and now with Alpine and with Aston Martin. This isn't new. You know, back in the early 1970s, when, you know, what we think of now as, you know, Lotus's, the Lotus 72, driven by, you know, guys like Ronnie Peterson, Emerson Fittipaldi, were winning world championships and driver championships, constructor championships. They weren't Lotuses.
Go on.
Yeah. They were, of course, Lotuses in every single way, apart from their names. They were called John Player Specials. They were called JPSs. And if you look at the press release that comes out, it'll just say new JPS2 or whatever, you know, the stuff that came out at the time. And that was a cigarette manufacturer doing exactly the same thick end of 50 years ago to what these guys are doing now. Now, I'm not saying that that in any way justifies it, but it is the way of the world. And all I would say is, you know, anybody who's saying, you know, on the point of going, you know, things ain't what they used to be. Well, they are, because people have been doing it for donkey's years.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just how it operates, how F1 operates, isn't it, really? So, yeah, there are four teams that I want to talk about. And actually, it's most helpful to think about them based on their current location. So we've got the Silverstone team, we've got the Enstone team, we've got the Brackley team, and the Milton Keynes team. And we'll come back to this, but you'll notice that they're all clustered around the sort of M40 corridor in the UK, Motorsport Valley, as it's known. And we'll talk about that a bit more later on. But let's start with the Silverstone team. In 2020, that was Racing Point. And of course, for this new season, it becomes Aston Martin, I think it is going to be fun to see the Aston Martin name competing in Formula One. Just because, well,
they were so they were so good at it the last time they tried.
Well, okay. Right. Okay, but we think, I mean, the Racing Point was, what, maybe the third or fourth quickest car out there last season. So hopefully they'll be competing for the odd podium, maybe a victory. Racing Point did score a win, didn't they, in 2020? So hopefully we'll see competitiveness.
If the car is as close to a modern, to the current Mercedes as this year's Racing Point was to the current, it was kind of like last year's car, wasn't it? Then, yeah, there's every reason to think that they will be super competitive because, you know, it goes back to what you're saying. The team itself doesn't change. You know, the name on the door might change, but inside it's the same people doing the same thing. As long as the money's there, which, you know, given who's behind the team, I'm guessing it will be, then there's no... I mean, I think that's quite exciting, isn't it?
I think it is. So before it was Aston Martin, it was Racing Point. And, of course, before... it was Racing Point. It was Force India for a decade. Force India became a very sort of familiar name on the F1 grid, didn't it? And before then, it was... Are you going to leap in now and tell me what that team was called for a year in 2007?
Oh, God. Hang on. Was it... I'm going to make it this so... This is going to be so embarrassing. Was it Midland?
Oh, so close. It was
no.
Midland. It was Midland in 2006, just for that year.
Oh, for goodness sake.
So there's a year in between. Orange livery, that might help.
Oh, yes, exactly. Yes, I know now. It was the bloody Spyker, wasn't it?
It was the bloody Spyker.
Okay, who drove the Spyker? Do you know, you could say absolutely anybody in the world, because I've got no idea.
I think Sutil did, because he was a Force India driver.
I really wouldn't know.
I think
you could say Ronald McDonald, and I wouldn't be able to tell you you were wrong.
Yeah, he had trouble fitting his feet in, didn't he? And before it was Midland in 2006, it was for a long time.
Oh, that I can do. Yeah, it was Jordan, wasn't it?
It was Jordan. It was Jordan.
It was Jordan. It was EJ's team.
EJ, yeah. Founded by Eddie Jordan. 91 was their first year. At the same base at Silverstone. Actually, I think there is a new facility coming for the Aston Martin squad, isn't there? Still at Silverstone, but on a slightly different site. But anyway, it's the Silverstone team, founded by Eddie Jordan in the early 90s.
The man who gave Michael Schumacher his break in Formula One.
Yeah. And how many races do we think that outfit has now won? Jordan won... was it just one?
Well, they won Spa, didn't they? Damon won Spa. No, they won more than that. No, because Frentzen won races in a Jordan. There was one season where Frentzen went into the last race of the season with a mathematical chance of being world champion.
Okay. So, and then with Perez's win last season. That's a small handful of wins that team has had over the years. That's good, isn't it?
Yeah.
So there we go. Aston Martin taking over a race-winning team. Well, there we go. Lots to be hopeful about there.
Aston Martin, just in case anybody is wondering about my earlier reference, did race in Formula One in 1959. And it was, I mean, the sad thing about it, I'm not going to drone on relentlessly because it's ancient history, but it was actually a really good car. And that's what people don't. People look at the results and it was hopeless and it didn't come anywhere and that sort of thing. It was a really good car if it had been introduced in 1957 when it was meant to have been done, because, you know, then it would have been super competitive. But by coming in 1959, what had happened in the interim was the mid-engine revolution had happened. And if you didn't have a mid-engine car by 1959, you weren't coming anywhere. And it wasn't a mid-engine car because it was late, because Aston Martin was too busy trying to win the World Sports Car Championship and so on and so forth. And so what was a really good car never came to anything. Unlike the successor, which was the DBR5 in 1960, which was an absolute dog's dinner of a car. And still had its engine in the wrong place.
And the latest intel tells us that the new Aston Martin F1 car will have its engine in the right place.
Is that right?
It's not going to be a front-engined F1 car. Exclusive.
Exclusive. You heard it first here.
Okay. Right, so the next team then is the Enstone team. Enstone is actually an airfield. Oh, it's a little village, isn't it, with an airfield connected to it in the Cotswolds. And it's where the Renault team has been based for the last couple of years, and that's becoming Alpine for 2021, which is interesting itself, isn't it? Because it wasn't too long ago that there were rumblings that Group Renault might be about to give Alpine the old heave-ho because, wasn't selling enough cars or whatever it might be. But now the group really appears to be backing the little sports car brand because it's becoming its F1 team. They're, you know, repurposing the Renault F1 team to Alpine. That's real backing, isn't it? That's reason.
It would certainly seem to be. You know, I'm always a bit of a cynic which comes to these things, and I'm always looking at, you know, how quickly they could engineer their way out of that. And of course, they could turn it back to Renault, or they could withdraw entirely. But at the same time, you know, it's quite a big statement, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is.
So, I mean, I don't know when those sorts of decisions get made, but, you know, I suspect it was probably decided during COVID and everything else. And, you know, obviously, you know, everybody's had a really, really tough time. But they still seem to think that the Alpine brand has, and we've talked about this before, haven't we, has legs. So, yes, I think on the surface, at least, it looks like a vote of confidence. But I'm just so cynical about any Formula One team that exists not for the purposes of racing. So, you know, there are teams like McLaren and Williams and so on and so forth. And, you know, Jordan back in the day, which only existed to race. You know, they weren't there to sell fizzy drinks or road cars or anything else. And, you know, when these things become marketing tools, which they are, for their manufacturers, whose primary business is not racing in Formula One, then I'm always a bit cynical, but and even suspicious. But you know, I think you can only go with what you know at any given moment in time. And from what we know, Renault appear to be four square behind Alpine, which is great news.
Yeah, and it's the Enstone team that's sort of chopped and changed more than any other, I think, really.
Oh no, you're not going to start quizzing me again.
Well, I don't know. Yes, actually. So it started off in Whitney. So not at Enstone at all, started off at Whitney in Oxfordshire in 1981 as Tolman.
Yes, I knew that.
Did you?
Yes.
Well, it's easy to say once I've told you, isn't it? as Tolman, of course, Senna raced for Tolman, didn't he?
He did. He had that amazing race in Monaco in 1984, which he should have won.
Yeah, he should have won.
Funnily enough, when it was raining and a Frenchman managed to get the Monaco Grand Prix stops to make sure that he won.
Baffling.
Who'd have thought it?
Baffling. And so this outfit, the Whitney / Enstone team, has got incredible heritage. So, of course, after Tolman, it became Benetton.
Yeah.
So when did it move over? Yeah, so during the Benetton years, that's when the move happened over to Enstone. And, of course, in the mid-90s, Benetton had enormous success, again with Schumacher, winning titles, winning lots of races. And then it was in 2002 that Benetton got rebranded Renault for the first time. And then, of course, quite soon after, there was enormous success again with the Alonso years.
Yes.
It's good, isn't it?
It's really good. It's really good.
And then there was that slightly baffling period where it became Lotus.
But they still won, didn't they?
Yeah, you know, with Kimi.
I continue to remind people certainly until the Racing Point win this year, the last race in Formula One to have been won by anything other than a Ferrari, a Red Bull, or a Mercedes was the 2013 Australian Grand Prix, which was won by Kimi in a car that called itself a Lotus.
Mm. Yeah, there was all sorts of weird legal wranglings going on, wasn't there, during that time, who had the rights to that name. But the Lotus, for a couple of years at least, was a really quick car, won races. And there was that brilliant story, wasn't there, that Kimi was on a fairly small retainer, but his bonus package was something like $100,000 per point. So if he won a race, that's £2.5 million in his pocket. Is that true? Don't know, but it's a good story.
Oh, well, I mean, I don't know if it is true, but it wouldn't surprise me in the least. I mean, I know, for instance, that race teams... I'm trying to think if I can remember a specific... I've got a name in my mind, but I won't say it just in case it's untrue in this particular case. But race teams that paid drivers on performance pay, you know, basis, so exactly what you say, where you get a certain amount of money per point score, then insured against their drivers scoring points.
Oh, that's brilliant.
So the better their drivers did, the bigger the insurance claim. They literally took out insurance against their drivers doing well.
I've never heard that before.
Yeah.
No, that's fantastic.
That definitely went on. Extraordinary, really.
Yeah. So after that brief Lotus spell, actually it's a handful of years, there was, again, it became Renault from 2016. And those were the Renault, the sort of rebuilding years, weren't they? And it looked a bit grim for a while. But 2020 was pretty good for Renault. Ricciardo got on the podium a couple of times, didn't he? And the team certainly looked more competitive than it has done in recent years. So we'll see what happens in 21 under the Alpine colours with Alonso in the car. As a, what is he, 40 years old now? Interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, he will be quick.
He posted a little clip on Instagram the other day of himself sat in an Alpine, looking all excited, at an A110 road car. So that was fun. Hopefully... Do you know what they need to do? They just need to stick Fernando in an A110 on track somewhere with a couple of GoPros attached and just say, go for it, and just release the raw footage. It'd be brilliant.
That'd be great. It would do millions, wouldn't it?
It would. It really would. Okay, so we've got two more teams to talk about. So we did mention Ken Tyrrell's team, Tyrrell, which started off in Ockham in Surrey we'll call it 1966. I think that was their first season in F1. And then in the late 90s, it got taken over by British American Racing, which is when it moved from Ockham to Brackley. And then, of course, it was Honda after that. Those were fairly dire years, weren't they? Although I think Jensen won his first race in 05 or 06,
Hungary.
Isn't it? Yeah, Hungary. I think that year's car was quick and he did well in the championship. But the last 2 years, 07, 08, my Earth dream... with that bizarre Planet Earth livery. That car was just dire. But then 2009 came around.
Yeah, I mean, that entire BAR Honda thing, I mean, it was... I mean, they just didn't deliver, did they? I'm afraid. The BAR, it was originally... That was Adrian Reynard, wasn't it? At the beginning, and he came into it. And the extraordinary thing about Reynard's is Reynard had never started in any new series without winning its first race. Everything they'd ever done, they'd gone out and won from the start. And so they, you know, and it's like, you know, so many other great race teams. I mean, you remember Lola, Lola did unbelievable things in, you know, almost every formula, but every so often they tried Formula One. And they just struggled. And I think it just gives you an idea of just what a step up it is, just how difficult it is. And frankly, how long it took. I mean, we know, don't we? For instance, you know, while we're talking about, you know, defunct Formula One teams, you know, how many seasons did Toyota do in Formula One without ever winning a race? Seven seasons, yeah. Was it?
Yeah.
I can't remember.
The amount of money spent.
The money spent. I mean, they were at the time the world's largest car company. You know, they dropped... You know, if you told me that, I don't know, a billion had gone into that program, you know, I wouldn't be that surprised. And what do they have to show for it? It just shows how difficult it is. And to an extent, I know that money talks, and, you know, you look at just what Mercedes are doing at the moment, you know, to know that the best funded teams tend always to do the best. But what it also shows is that money, although money is probably the most important component, it's not the only one, isn't it? Is it? You know, you've got to have the ideas, you've got to have the execution, you've got to be able to take that money and do the right things with it, or else you're still going to come nowhere.
Yeah. Too true. And we know what happened in 2009 with the Brackley team.
Oh, yes.
When Honda pulled out, looked like the team wouldn't be racing. And then the takeover led by Braun, and just that remarkable fairy tale season that saw...
The double diffuser,
yeah. And it was only the first sort of third of the season that the team dominated, wasn't it? For beyond that point, with Jensen having won, what was it, six of the first seven or something... The team struggled, but they'd done enough at the start of the year to win both championships. And it was the most amazing thing.
I can remember Ross Brawn telling me that in that, when they were absolutely dominant, when they were just, you know, running away with it, that they'd put stuff on the car that had no noticeable effect on the car's performance whatsoever, just because they knew that others would come looking at it because they were so far ahead. People would think, oh no, they got another amazing aerodynamic gizmo, so we have to go and analyse that. And they would burn so much of other teams' times. And whatever these things were, they stuck on the car. The only rule was that they couldn't make the car slower. So as long as they were performance neutral, they and I just love to me, that is the way to go racing. I just love the idea, because
the spirit.
That's not cheating, is it, at all? That's just being very, very clever. That's not just looking at what you're up to. That's just thinking, how can we make life even more difficult for these poor sods trying to keep up with us at the moment? And just putting stuff on the cars and then going, oh no, what's that?
It's like having one very fast but fragile car at Le Mans that scampers off in the early hours, isn't it?
Yeah.
To try and break the other team's cars.
The hair, yes, absolutely. Yeah, the hair. And are you the team manager who's brave enough to say, don't chase the hair?
Yeah. It's great, isn't it? We love that stuff. So, yeah, I mean, with that amazing year in 2009, and then, of course, Mercedes took over the team from 2010 onwards. And actually, it looked as though... But with Schumacher back, and it looked as though it was going to be a bit of a busted flush, that return.
It had a whiff of the Toyotas about it, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. It did. And then the rule change in 2014, the huge regulation change that year. And then it's just been total dominance ever since.
Okay,
well, another team, the final team that I want to talk about, and dominance is very true here as well for a spell, the Milton Keynes team, which we now know as Red Bull, utterly dominant from 2010 to 2013 with Sebastian Vettel, not so dominant under its previous guise as Jaguar Racing, 2000 to 2004. That's another one to talk about, isn't it? Big OEMs coming in.
Yeah, before that, can we talk a bit about what it was even before then?
We can do. 96.
Stewart Grand Prix.
Yeah, that was where the team actually started.
It started as Paul Stewart Racing.
Yeah.
That's the amazing thing. You know, I know Paul a bit because he doesn't race anymore, but he often turns up and does demos at historic events that I'm at and that sort of thing. And I sat down and had lunch with him quite recently. Absolutely fascinating bloke. Don't forget, this is a bloke who got cancer at the age of 34 and had to retire from the Jaguar Formula One thing. I mean, the stress of that job was just off the scale. But before that, I mean, he'd been a pretty successful racing driver. I think he knew he was never going to be as good as his dad. But Paul Stewart Racing, before it went into Formula One, they won everything. I mean, they were utterly dominant in, I can't remember, all the junior Formula. You know, if you wanted to win Formula, you know, you had to go and race with Paul. And Paul, for a while, was not only running the team, but he was racing for it as well. And I think it was only because they basically won everything that they could win that they were looking around and thinking, what next? And because Jackie was obviously very well connected, and, you know, particularly well connected with Ford, that they were able to put together the deal that, you know, that started, Stewart Grand Prix. And, you know, Stewart Grand Prix, for a tiny little team that did nothing and came out of nowhere, I said did nothing, you know, I mean, what I mean is, you know, had started from nothing, They did really good stuff. Do you remember Rubens coming second at Monaco in the rain because he didn't stop and everybody else did? And I can remember there's some footage of Jackie literally in floods of tears, which you'd never have seen him do in his Formula One career. It meant that much more to him. And then, of course, towards the end of Stewart, they got pretty successful. I can't remember. Johnny won the British Grand Prix for them, didn't they? I mean, they had a really strong season. And I guess that's why, one of the reasons that Jaguar thought they could come in and, you know, bung a load of money behind it and, you know, sweep all before them. But as we know, there's many a slip, isn't there?
Many, yeah. Another example, like Toyota. Yeah, the Jaguar thing just didn't really work out, did it?
I went to its very first race.
Go on. What was the atmosphere like?
Melbourne, 2000. Well, I mean, Jaguar appeared to have bought the city. I can remember staggering off the 747 and literally in the airway that linked the aircraft to the terminal building. All the adverts down the side of it were leapers, you know, the cat's back, Jaguar this, Jaguar that. And, you know, I don't really know enough about it, but, you know, the cars had both problems, didn't they? If you're going to design a Formula One car, you know, if it's quick and unreliable, well, okay, fine, you can address the unreliability, maybe at a cost of a bit of speed. Or if it's very reliable but not very quick, then perhaps you can, you know, cut back your margins a bit more and make it. But if it is both not very fast and unreliable, which that Jaguar was, you kind of got nowhere to go. And I think it was relative to expectations and, just as something where we all just thought that Jaguar, having also, don't forget, achieved so much in Group C and sports cars and everything else, we just thought, you know, they're going to come and, you know, and do the same in Formula One. And again, you know, I'm afraid they just showed that it's not as easy as that. And I felt very sorry for Paul because I know how hard he worked. And they had some really, really good people there. I think, who was driving? It was Johnny and Eddie, wasn't it? You know, who were both, you know, good drivers, both of whom either had or would go on to win, you know, a reasonable number of Grand Prix. So I don't think that they were particularly deficient in that department. But the car wasn't right. And I think the faster they tried to make it, the less reliable it became. And it was just, you know, they did five seasons, I think. And did they get a podium? I can't remember. They might have. I got a funny feeling. I got a memory of Johnny sitting in a press conference. But I don't know.
Fingers burnt. So all four of those teams are now in that Motorsport Valley region of the UK. And of course, Williams is in there. McLaren isn't in that region, but it is in the UK. And Haas, its headquarters in the US, of course, but its Formula One outfit is based out of Banbury, also in the Motorsport Valley area. And so that puts six of the current Formula One teams in Motorsport Valley, seven in the UK. 7 out of 10. That's good, isn't it? And it's interesting that so many of the teams have found themselves based in the UK, and it sort of becomes self-fulfilling in a way. If all the expertise and resource is in one spot, you almost have to be there.
Yeah, I mean, it would seem almost perverse, isn't it, to set up shop anywhere else? Because, you know, how do you go about recruiting the expertise? How do you get the talent? How do you persuade that many people to relocate to? I mean, I guess if you set one up in Tahiti or somewhere absolutely lovely, then you know, that might be
a thought.
But you're just making life more difficult for yourself, aren't you? So you're absolutely right. You know, nothing succeeds like success. And, you know, the reason it's been like that and has been like that for so very long is because it's like that. And you don't have to think about it any harder than that. But it is interesting just to think for a moment as to why it became that, because it wasn't always that way.
No.
You know, I'm just trying to think. So, you know, the Formula One, I mean, before Formula One, when there was still Grand Prix racing, the British were completely hopeless. You know, you had, what did you have? You had ERAs, which were quite good at voiturette racing, but, you know, were hopeless at the top level. You had, in sports car racing, yes, you had Bentley winning a load of Le Mans in the 1920s and, you know, and a lot of Lagonda won one in 1935. But you know, at the top level, we had no presence in Grand Prix racing, really. And then at the beginning of the 50s, you had, you know, plucky efforts like BRM coming to absolutely nothing. And it was really only towards, you know, so Vanwall were probably the first, weren't they? I mean, okay, so the first Briton to win a Grand Prix, it was a non-championship race in a British car, was Tony Brooks, won at Syracuse Grand Prix in 1955. And then after that, yeah, you remember the ways the Italians dominated, basically it's Ferrari and Alfa, and then Mercedes briefly in the middle of the 1950s. And then suddenly, you know, Vanwall comes along and wins the first ever Constructors' Trophy, and then come the mid-engine guys. Then comes Cooper, and everything changes. You know, Jack Brabham wins the World Championship in 1959 and 1960 with Cooper. And then, okay, Ferrari then get it back for 1961, but they rest on their laurels. And then after that, you know, the Brits with BRM and with Lotus and, you know, and Cooper to an extent. The Garagistas, as Ferrari used to rather disparagingly call them, just took control and they've never stopped. It was, and I think it was just down to innovation, wasn't it? It was just down to, you know, when your opposition or principal opposition was Ferrari, which, you know, which was, as a team back then, certainly was very traditional in its thinking. They absolutely believed that the engine was the way forward. And the Brits took a different view. They just thought, no, we, you know, you can have all the power in the world, but if your car is heavy or, you know, the engine that's providing it is in the wrong place, then you're not going to be making the most of it. And we can actually make cars which aren't just quick in a straight line, but which stop well, which go around corners well. And I think it was that revolution which basically handed the advantage to Britain, and we've never given it back.
Yeah, they've just sort of held on to it. And after the 60s, 70s era, Williams and McLaren both had periods of dominance and enormous success between them. And it, so it's interesting to sort of look at how it happened in the first place, how in the 50s Formula One, the sort of the UK became the epicenter of it. Last year, while I was still editing Motorsport UK's in-house magazine, it's called Revolution, I got our mate Colin Goodwin to write a piece about how Formula One, how the UK became home to 7 of the 10 Formula One teams. What exactly happened there? And he wrote a really interesting piece with some good ideas. Of course, I suspect there are lots of different factors, but he had some good ideas. One of which was, after the war, you know, we had all these airfields that were surplus to requirements, didn't need to fly in and out of them anymore. And so they became racetracks. And that just helps, doesn't it? If there are lots of circuits available, it just helps a Formula One design and construction industry to crop up. That's, of course, how Silverstone was once an RAF base and is now home of the British Grand Prix.
And if you think about the talent that you need, you know, that's, you know, it's not just about the drivers or just about the circuits. It's about, you know, creating that business, which then creates employment, which then draws people to it. And then suddenly you have an industry, and from that industry, you can pluck the talent. That's how it starts, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And the other thing that Goodwin pointed out is that, so really, it was the southeast of England that was this hotbed of engineering capability. And a lot of it is to do with the Second World War, because there was so much skill, so much expertise when it came to fabrication, welding chassis, turning components on lathes, says Goodwin, panel beating, working soft alloys, all those skills that you needed to construct aircraft were useful also for racing cars.
But it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, the war obviously ended in 1945, and yet we didn't really establish dominance until, what, 15 years later. So, yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Maybe these things take a lot of time to, for want of a better word, repurpose themselves.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. And then, of course, at some point a little bit later on, there was this sort of exodus from the southeast, just because the teams were getting bigger. They needed more staff, they needed bigger premises, and the southeast was too expensive. And so where did they go? Well, they scooted off up the M40. Was the M40 even there? I don't know. But, you know, up that region, and set up shop in Oxfordshire and that sort of area. And that's how Motorsport Valley came to be. And now we have 6 of the 10 Formula One teams based in a very, very small area, with actually a huge number of related businesses. The numbers that Goodwin offered us were 4,500 companies in the UK that are directly related to motorsport, together employing directly 45,000 people. It's just an enormous industry, and worth 10 billion.
How much?
10 billion a year to the UK.
Yeah, I can believe it. And, you know, and if you look at the ripples as they spread out through the supply chain, it'll be much more than that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It's enormous, isn't it? It's become such a part of British industry, and something that, I don't know, I actually feel quite proud of it, that this little country of ours is home to so much talent, expertise, capability, innovation.
Yeah. And we mustn't be too sort of flag waving, tub thumping about it, because, you know, because, you know, these teams are based in Britain, but they draw in talent from all over the world. And they are, you know, if you have been into any Formula One team, you will always be amazed by the number of different accents that you hear, because people do come to it from all over. But even so, I think it's fantastic that, you know, a company like Mercedes-Benz, you know, one of the biggest, most revered, successful car companies on earth, you know, everything on that car, you know, from its engine to its tub and everything else, is done in either Brixworth or Brackley. And, you know, it is an entirely British team, albeit paid for by Mercedes-Benz, you know, and staffed by, you know, lots of people from many, many different nations. But I think you're absolutely right. I think it is something that we can be genuinely proud of, you know, because we lead the world in that, at least.
That, at least, if nothing else. Well, we haven't even mentioned Lotus, proper Lotus, not really, or not got stuck into Brabham either. So we'll have to leave those for another podcast. But there we go. That's the Formula One family tree. I just think it's great that you can trace the most dominant team there's ever been, all the way back to the 1960s and Ken Tyrrell. Partly because my maternal grandmother's maiden name was Tyrrell, and her son, my uncle, swears that his own uncle was the spitting image of Ken Tyrrell. So I reckon there might even be a little connection there somewhere.
I know someone who could find that connection for you.
Oh, really?
Yes, I do. Yes, this really isn't podcast material, but my wife's sister's partner's mother.
Oh my God! Okay, yeah.
Is a retired spook. She used to work for GCHQ, She's incredibly intelligent and incredibly bored, and so and she's really, really good at finding out stuff. And because I knew nothing about my family history, we got her on the case. And in the end, I had to ask her to stop. Once she'd found over 500 relatives, which is why I know, for instance, that I am Nigella Lawson's sixth cousin.
Oh, but isn't everyone Nigella Lawson's sixth cousin or something?
Almost certainly. But yeah, so if you ever want to find out whether you really are Ken Tyrrell's something, 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 many times removed, I could put you in touch with someone who will find out for you.
Okay, very good. To be discussed then. We'll announce the results in a future podcast episode. We'll leave that one there. Well, there we go. We're back underway. New year, lots to be optimistic about, and we'll get back into weekly podcasts. Actually, we're going to do more than that soon, aren't we? There's going to be so much more to come from us at DN. We can't say too much at the moment, but I think this is going to be a good year for DN, and hopefully you'll all enjoy it.
It should be, well, we hope. The reason we're not saying anything is because plans aren't finalised yet. But we certainly know what we want to do, and we think we know how we're going to do it. We just haven't done it yet, which is why we are being a little bit coy. But we're very excited about it. If it all comes to fruition, we hope you'll be very excited about it. We hope that you'll come with us, and lots more to say on that in the hopefully not too distant future.
Watch this space, and we'll be back to talk to you again next week.
Look forward to it. All the best.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.